course, just as if it seems to know, I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart. Don't you know I'll close my eyes, and I'll see you with my heart.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this February 1st, 2012 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. I'm your host, Marie Stone. This is Writers on Writing. We are dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, Barbara and I are here with authors, poets, agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. I'm joined now by Naomi Benarin, and coming up in the second half hour, Meg Rossoff will be here discussing her latest young adult novel, There Is No Dog. Naomi Benarin holds a master's degree in fine arts from Antioch University and a master's of science degree in earth sciences from Scripps Institute of Oceanography. She is also an Ironman triathlete. She teaches at UCLA Extension Writers Program and mentors for the Afghan Women's Writing Project. She works as an advocate for African refugees in the community and has worked extensively with genocide survivors in Rwanda. She is the winner of the G.S. Sharat Chandra Prize for Short Fiction for Love Letters from a Fat Man and the 2005 Lorian Hemingway Short Story Competition. Her debut novel is Running the Rift. It's published by Algonquin. It was released last Thursday. It's already one of Amazon's best books of the month for January, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Naomi, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you for coming on. What a fantastic debut novel. So it started out, tell me a little bit about the genesis of this. It started out as a project during your MFA program as a short story and then sort of evolved. Can you talk a little bit about the origins of the book, where the idea came from, and kind of how it evolved?
Sure. Well, the very first idea, excuse me, was when I saw a young man from somewhere in West Africa who swam a wild card heat in the 100 freestyle event in the Olympics in 2000. And he just swam with so much heart that it stuck in my heart. The next thing that happened was I started taking fiction classes at Pima Community College, and I was assigned to write a story about a place that was very unfamiliar. So I transformed this story into something that took place in Burundi because I had a friend from Burundi. He was still a swimmer. Then I went to Rwanda later in 2002, and I fell in love with the country from the minute I saw it. It's just such a beautiful country, and the people were so beautiful and friendly and just really warm and outgoing, which surprised me given what they had been through. And then one day I was walking on the lake, and my foot hit something hard, and I picked it up, and it was a human bone. And then I actually got down on my hands and knees and saw that there were bones everywhere in the sand. And I picked them up and held them in my hands, and it was as if these bones were telling me a story. And I thought about how they would never be able to tell their own story, and that was really the seed of Running the Rift as it came to be. And then when I committed to writing a novel as my senior project at Antioch, that's when it started. So that would be 2005.
And I'm sorry, tell me again when you first went to Rwanda.
The first time I went was 2002.
Okay.
And the country was still really reeling from the genocide. There were the walls with bullet holes. There were burnt out shells of buildings. And really outside Kigali, it was a war zone still at that time.
And remind me again what took you there originally.
What took me there originally actually was my dog trainer. I was going to meet this friend of mine from Burundi, and he is, surprise, surprise, an 800-meter runner. He ran for Burundi in the Olympics, so that's how my character evolved into an 800-meter runner. But I was telling my dog trainer about this, and she said, oh, my God, I'm in love with Rwanda, and I've been invited to this woman, Roz Carr. She's an expat, lived in Rwanda, had an orphanage for genocide survivors, and Roz had invited her to her 90th birthday, so I went along for the ride.
Amazing, amazing. And I love how these projects start out of writing assignments, so writing about a place that you don't know. And, you know, that goes so contrary to what a lot of writers are told, which is write what you know.
Yes.
So, you know, to be put to the task of writing about a foreign place, I think that's great. That's great. So tell us a little bit about, why don't you introduce us to the novel for those that haven't yet read Running the Rift. Tell us a little bit about kind of the arc and content of the novel.
Running the Rift follows the story of Jean-Patrick Nhuba, who is a young Tutsi boy, and he's coming of age right in the years surrounding the genocide. The novel starts in 1984, which is a period of relative peace in Rwanda. The president, Habyarimana, has promised to do away with the divisive identity cards that tell if you're Hutu or Tutsi. He's promised to kind of put a lid on ethnic violence that had been boiling periodically over the years. So it's a time of hope. Nhuba means the god of thunder, so Jean-Patrick has a very important name to live up to. At the beginning of the novel, his father, who was a teacher at a secondary school called Gihundwe, dies in a traffic accident. Jean-Patrick and his family move in with his uncle, his mother's brother, so they move to the shores of Lake Kivu, which is the forms the border between Rwanda and Congo and Burundi. And then it kind of follows him. The two things that Jean-Patrick wants more than anything in the world, he wants to further his education, and he wants to run in the Olympics. As the novel progresses, the environment in Rwanda becomes increasingly restrictive for Tutsi, and it's about how Jean-Patrick fights to succeed and also fights to kind of keep his head buried in the sand and not think about politics despite his brothers becoming a member of the rebel forces and fighting the government and his uncle being a supporter of these rebels. Jean-Patrick doesn't want anything to do with it. And then, of course, there has to be a love story. So Jean-Patrick falls in love with a young Hutu woman who's an opposition Hutu, and her father is a journalist and was jailed in 1991 for his opposition to Habyarimana's regime. And then, of course, the genocide interferes with everything.
You know, it's funny. I didn't know a terrible amount about what was happening in Rwanda until the movie Hotel Rwanda came out. And I'm wondering, as you're writing something that is so removed, for at least from an American audience's experience, how much knowledge that you have to. I mean, that I think that movie went a long way to sort of open our eyes if we weren't paying attention in the 90s when I was, I don't know, doing other things in college or something. I don't know what I was doing. But
right.
How much knowledge to assume on the part of the reader, and how to impart that information without being overly didactic or, you know, preachy?
That was a really tricky question and took a lot of revision. I've been to Rwanda 4 times for extended visits. I've read everything I could possibly read about Rwanda. And I've also, along the way, made some very, very dear friends from Rwanda and in Rwanda. When I went, I would stay with my friends in Rwanda. So I really tried as much as I could to immerse myself in the culture, to understand the culture, to get some beginning feel for the language. It's, for me, it was a very difficult language. The rules are quite different. But my feeling was that it was extremely important to approach the novel with respect, with love, and with honesty, and to be as true as a Westerner possibly could be, both to the history and to the culture.
Yeah, yeah. Not an easy task.
No, it wasn't. And I, you know, many times I would find myself staring at the page thinking, what right do I have to do this? But every time I asked that question of my Rwandan friends, they would tell me, not only do you have the right, but you have the obligation. And to me, the key is that we don't have the voices of those people in Rwanda because, well, number one, they're just now learning to speak English. French was their official Western language. Many people don't even speak French. And the other thing is that they've been busy trying to get their lives together after the horrific events.
Right, right. I want to pick up on that thread of language that you were talking about in their language and learning their language. And some of the things that struck you as you were, you know, how they say, you know, Eskimos have 1,000 words for snow. Some of the things that struck you about their language in terms of how they view the world, perhaps differently. I'm sure they view the world differently than a Western audience, but how that is reflected in their language, if you were able to pick up any of that in studying with them.
A couple of things about the language. Until fairly recently, Kinyarwanda was an oral language. It's also a language of poetry. I've spent a lot of time just listening to the sound, the tone, the beat of the language, and it's a very beautiful, musical, there's almost a chant-like feel to it. So that's one thing. And the other thing, it's so immersed in their mythology. Like, there's all these sayings that come from their mythology and their origin myths and all these wonderful, they're just so poetic in the way they express things. Like, if you have a lot of red marks on your paper, if, you know, the professor has made a lot of corrections, they say your professor killed a cow on your paper. there's a lot of, especially with the Tutsi, because the Tutsi were the keepers of the cattle, so a lot of the language has to do with cows. Cows, milk jugs. It's amazing how many expressions and turns of phrase revolve around milk and cattle.
Yeah, they sound much more, I mean, coming from Southern California, they sound much more, I mean, very connected to the earth. And,
yes,
and
absolutely.
There was a great interview you did with yourself. This was great. You interviewed yourself in sort of a third-person, first-person thing, which I read. And you were talking about the food there being so much of the earth and feeling earthy. And And yeah, what a connection that Americans have completely lost.
I know, it's so sad. How much time do we spend sitting at little plastic tables with little, well, I don't really eat little plastic meals at little plastic tables, but you know, it's everywhere around you.
Yeah, right.
And we've really lost the sense of what that food is and where it comes from. And that is such a connection in Rwanda. And sharing food is such an important aspect of their culture. You know, people can be as poor as dirt, but when you go to their house, they will offer you something.
I love it.
Yeah.
You are listening to 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. We are streaming online at kuci.org, and we podcast these interviews. This will be up in a couple of weeks. My guest this morning is Naomi Benarin, and the book is Running the Rift. I want to talk a little bit about the complexities of writing atrocity and being respectful. This had such a beautiful tone of being respectful to the culture and being respectful to the events that happened, but conveying them in you know, truthful, hard ways. And, you know, I think as Americans, or maybe as, you know, 21st century folk or something, we are so desensitized, and we feel kind of beat over the head with the news at night. And it's hard to get into us, I think, anymore. And, you know, we kind of feel like we've heard it all. Tell me a little bit about your process of trying to write these events in a, you know, such a delicate, sort of truthful, respectful way.
I have to say that my mentor in all of this is Ann Michaels and her book Fugitive Pieces, which is one of the most beautiful Holocaust novels that I've ever read. It's like reading a poem, and so it's not that I want to turn this violence into some beautiful poem, but I think you want to walk, or at least I wanted to walk, the very fine line that I didn't want someone, I think if you beat someone over the head with violence, they just cover their heads and it doesn't go in. Whereas if you kind of keep it just a little bit off stage, it resonates much more in the reader's mind, and I think it is more powerful because it allows the reader to actively engage their own imagination.
Yeah, you have, interesting, you've mentioned many times over the course of the interview so far and in other interviews you've done, your connection to poetry. And I actually thought this was interesting. I know you're a triathlete and that a lot of your running has resonated with the running in the book. But you made this beautiful observation about how running kind of puts the rhythm of language in your head, and how a lot of ideas are generated during your long runs, and that sort of rhythmic drumbeat, I think, that comes with running. I've never run unless I was chased, but I can imagine that's what it's like. But anyway, yeah, tell me a little bit about, you started out as a poet and then sort of emerged as a novelist. Tell me a little bit about that.
I started out as a really bad poet who wrote lots of bad poetry in journals all over the years. Actually, the first thing I remember writing was in first grade. I wrote a story about a Luna moth. That was my first foray into fiction, or creative nonfiction, I guess it was. But then, you know, as a teenager, of course, you just write all those horrible poems about how awful your life is. But then I've always been drawn to story. Ever since I was a little girl, I've always been making up stories, and I always forced my mother to make up stories for me. But the interesting thing was that I made her make her stories rhyme, which now I really feel sorry for her. That's quite a task. So I think I consider myself a fiction writer. First I was a short story writer, and now I'm seem to be more of a novelist, which creates some angst in my life. But a novelist who appreciates the poetry of language and who attempts to infuse prose with the poetry of language.
Yeah, that really comes through in the novel. That really resonates.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about research. You touched on this a little bit about all of the reading that you did and the time that you spent in Rwanda researching the novel. Were there other unconventional things that came out of your research or other unconventional methods that you used to research this, maybe not reading or immersive, but other things that you did? And tell me a little bit about some of the biggest surprises that emerged in your research process.
Well, one thing I actually went to in 2008, I went to observe the commemoration of the genocide in Rwanda, and that was one of the most difficult journeys I have put myself through. It's really kind of, it's an amazing thing to stand in churches and in schools where this horrific violence has taken place. And in many of the genocide sites, they've left the rooms as they were. So there's actually, there's blood on the walls, and there's like grenade and bullet holes that, like, you can see these kind of starbursts of light through the church, the ceilings in the churches where there are bullet holes and where grenades have been thrown through them. And then they have like these catacombs with the bones of the people. And I just found that to be a really traumatic experience, but also it really evoked in me a need to create something good from that. Yeah. I don't know if that's really answering your question or touching on it. I think just mostly the unexpected steps along the way. I approach fiction kind of like grazing, like you go through life kind of choosing this and that, and you ingest it, and then later on it will come out in your fiction. Like on that trip, I have kind of an unofficially adopted son, and on that trip, I had the good fortune of taking a bus ride with him on public bus, and they were the most amazing. He was translating all these conversations that went on around me, and they were hysterically funny, and so a lot of those kind of ended up somehow in the book. So I was really fortunate to have that. Was a surprise because I never expected that to happen. That was one thing.
You need that layer of humor to just take it, right? I mean, you know,
yes,
so
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you need, I guess, a lot of different textures and layers in this, but you know, the underlying theme is so hard to take that if you don't have humor, it's hard for your reader to breathe. And I'm sure it was hard for you to breathe through some of this.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think that's what one of the things that really made me admire and love the people that I met, because they have this really wonderful, complex twist of wit in what they say. Their language is very witty, and it's kind of this terse, dry humor that's really delightful to have some understanding of.
The interesting thing about this to me, you know, I talk to writers who write from parts of all over the world, and we talk about, you know, trying to get into characters who are so different than Americans or so different than, you know, wherever we're from, and the universality of human experience. And, you know, in the end, we're all human beings and we all share similar emotions. The thing that strikes me about this, though, is that the things in here feel so far removed from any realm of experience that Americans have had, the things that people have had to endure, the ways that, as you were talking about, that they kind of commune with nature and commune with the world and the earth and, you know, let's not even mention the layer of war on top of all of that. It feels like it. And you described one Hutu that had some really non-remorseful sort of reactions in the aftermath of this, that it's almost hard to relate to that experience. And I was wondering if you had problems in accessing some of these characters in trying to find the common ground when you were drawing these characters out.
I did. I had a lot of problems. And in order to paint them as fully and as accurately as possible. And it's not, that sounds so clinical, but in order to occupy their hearts and their minds and their souls, I really had to understand them. I know this sounds weird, but down to their underwear.
Yeah.
Like I had to know, you know, I had to know how they dressed from the beginning to the end. I had to know how they approached their days, how do they take a shower? And so I had all these little questions, and I was lucky enough to have friends that I was comfortable enough with to ask all these kind of strange questions to. And sometimes I would even, like the main female character, Bea, I had a real problem understanding her for some reason. But then I had her write me a letter. And when she wrote me that letter, it all of a sudden put her and me on the same level. Mm-hmm. And I could really gain access to her as a human being. And after that, it was never the same. She resonated with me after she wrote me that letter and told me who she was. And that's also another reason why Jean Patrick, the main character, is a scientist and a runner, because these are both things that I understand and that I think a love for the physical nature and the physical laws of the world and a love for athleticism and for competition really transcend culture. I think it's the same for all of us.
Yeah. So did you find yourself doing that process with each individual character, trying to find your own door into them and kind of your own path of connection to them?
Yes. Yeah, most definitely.
And tell me a little bit about voice for each character. Did you, all their voices are fairly unique, and I'm wondering about, switching from kind of one mentality to the next. Was accessing voice for each one its own process?
Yes, it was. And I had to spend some time with each of the characters writing in first person. So that never made it into the novel, obviously, but it's all third person, mostly through Jean Patrick's point of view. But I had to write sections in first person for each of the characters to understand who they were, how they thought, what drove them.
My guest this morning is Naomi Benarin. The book is Running the Rift, and you are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're drawing down on our time, but I have a couple more questions that's so all fascinating to me. I also was wondering, when this set out as a novel for sort of social justice, I know it was the winner of the Bellwether Prize, and if you sort of began with kind of this platform or message that you intended to relate to the reader, or if that sort of you just had this human story that you wanted to tell, and the rest of the commentary sort of came in the aftermath, or tell me a little bit about your intentions for this being a social justice sort of novel.
I think it's something that evolves naturally from my writing. I was brought up in a house hold where social justice was front and center all the time. My mother came from Eastern Europe. She was active in anti-Nazi movements to the point where she and her family had to flee from Eastern Europe at the last moment to avoid deportation to occupied Germany. She was a communist back in the days when it was popular to be a communist, and communism meant something really different. It was something very idealistic. She was very involved in civil rights. She was very involved with anti-war. We always had big anti-war meetings at our house and parties to raise money. So it was something that I never even had to think of. It was just a natural process that this would be what I wrote about.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say I never set out to write a novel with a message, and I think really to do that can end up being very destructive for a person's writing.
Yeah.
So it was just there was a story that I needed to tell, and most stories that I need to tell on some level, and most poems that I write involve social justice, because that's what I think about and that's what moves me.
I'll read you a quote that you said, which I think is gorgeous.
Thank you.
So often in a book, the belief system you have developed about its world shatters, only to reveal another layer of the world that seems truer, a different and brighter light shining on it. And that is what this novel seems to have accomplished. That I don't know for your process of writer what it was like, but that is sort of what it felt like from the reader's perspective. It was great.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
That's great. Any closing words of advice or wisdom for writers?
Be true to your heart. That's the best thing I can say. And that when I went through a lot of times when things looked very bleak and I seriously questioned if my novel would ever be published, but I couldn't let it go. So my advice is don't ever let your true writing go.
I like it. Great advice. Great advice. Naomi Benarin, this was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure for me too. Thanks
for the congratulations on all the success with this. This is great. Amazon is doing its part to get this novel out there. So that's great.
I know. I'm really grateful to them for that.
Yeah.
I'm great, and to the independent bookstores.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
I've been really warmly received, so I have to put my shout in for the indie market.
Absolutely. We are huge proponents of indie bookstores on here. I was going to say, you know, I have my reservations about Amazon, but
yes.
You know, when they're championing good books, it's always good to get the word out there, but buy them from your local independent bookstores because
there you go.
Got to keep them going. All right, Naomi, thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Meg Rossoff will be here in the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Claudia Shambaugh, your host of Ask a Leader, airing on Tuesday mornings from 9 until 10. Join me as we explore the worlds of leaders of all stripes, of all ages, from all realms of our society. These leaders may be voted into office, appointed, anointed, or volunteers. We'll examine them all in this show. Subjects include politics, government, religion, human rights, culture, physical and mental health, and more. We'll find leaders in places the rest of us aren't even looking.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Every Tuesday night from 6 to 8 p.m. is the incredible Rachel Ray's Cooking Accident. Host Heather McCoy takes you on a musical journey from off-kilter pop, jazz, experimental, indie rock, and every subgenre in between. Rachel Ray's Cooking Accident, on where else but 88.9 FM KUCI Irvine.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes. We are under College Radio. Or you can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for more direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series, events, and more. If you're listening to us live this morning, just a note that we've been having some trouble with our podcasts, and we are slowly, one by one, getting them back up on the web and getting them correctly linked. So if you are experiencing trouble, you are not alone. The problem is not yours. And stick with us. We are slowly in the process of restoring all of them. There are hundreds and hundreds of interviews. Barbara has been doing this show for 14 years, so you can imagine how many interviews are up there and in the restoration process, so please bear with us. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm joined now by Meg Rossoff. Meg's debut novel, How I Love Now, won the Michael J. Prince Award and was an ALA Best Book for Young Adults. Her second novel, Just in Case, won the 2007 CILIP Carnegie Medal and was an ALA Best Book for Young Adults. When I Was, Meg's third novel, was shortlisted for the 2008 CILIP Carnegie Medal. Her latest already widely banned book is There Is No Dog. It's published by Putnam, a division of Penguin here in the U.S. And Meg joins me this morning from London. Meg, welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Thank you. Every time I see the word banned book, I immediately bring it on the show. I love that.
Oh, well, it's a nice consolation prize.
It gets me going. I love that. So I will first give you a chance for those who have not yet picked up There Is No Dog. I think it's pretty recently out here in the U.S. So.
It is just a week.
Yeah, just a week old. Perfect. So I will give you a chance to introduce it, talk about where the idea came from, and take us into it, and then we'll take that as a leaping off point for some of our other questions.
Okay, well, the book, the title comes from a very old joke, punchline, about a dyslexic atheist who's walking up and down in front of a church with a board that says, "There is no dog." And the idea really came from a radio show that my husband heard about all the people who'd ever played God in the movies, and they were all old white guys. And he said, "Why isn't it ever a teenage kid?" And I just suddenly thought that there was an incredible resonance between the idea of the creator of this kind of messed up world being an adolescent, you know, someone who's too self-centered, who's lazy, who does all of creation in 6 days because he can't really be bothered to think it through. And the idea kind of went on from there. So in my book, Bob is a 19-year-old boy, and he's done all of creation, and he's done it too quickly, and he forgets to put food down for the carnivores, so they all have to eat each other. And he does, one day he's sort of hanging around, ignoring his people as usual. And he's got an assistant who's sort of my age, and a little prayer comes up from a girl on earth, and it says, "Dear God, I would really love to fall in love." And God, or Bob, happens to be looking over the shoulder of his assistant, and he sees the prayer, and then he sees the girl, and he falls madly in love with this earth girl. And, you know, that's sort of the top line of it. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff going on in it, and a lot of questions about mortality and faith and all that sort of stuff, but it's a comedy. So is that good enough?
That is great enough. It's a fantastic comedy. It's very funny. So when you set out to do it, were you sort of intentionally walking into a little bit of controversy and sort of prodding at people, or was that just a happy byproduct in the end?
You know, I think there's, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I talked to lots of other writers, and there's sort of two kinds of writers, especially for the kind of teenage market, and there are a lot of people who are out there courting controversy, and, you know, there's a lot of talk about being the first to break some taboo, but I basically just write the books that pop into my head, and I don't think too much about the consequences of them, which, you know, is either a good thing or a bad thing, depending on how you look at it. My mother in California always thinks that someone's going to put a bomb under my car, but so far that hasn't happened.
I'm wondering how it plays differently in the UK versus the US, because the US, especially in the last, I don't know, 10 to 20 years, I don't know, maybe the last 50 years, but we feel so uptight to me. And so, you know, the religious right feels like it's taking even more center stage than it used to. And I'm wondering if that's the case in London or if there's a little bit more freedom over there and some of these ideas are a little bit better received than maybe on this side. I don't know.
It's a very complicated question. Yes, I mean, you know, I always think that the church, speaking as an American, you know, and a Jewish American, I always think that the church of, married to a guy from the Church of England, that the Church of England is kind of almost a synonym for atheism. You know, they wear their religion very lightly, and the Archbishop of Canterbury always seems a bit embarrassed that he has to speak for the church. But having said that, the book has been banned by a number of Christian schools. You know, I'm not sure whether they've read it or not, but they clearly have trouble with a concept. And then, you know, America, we all look at America from over here, as the land of Newt Gingrich and all his right-wing cronies and the Sarah Palin and the extreme right. But then, you know, it's so easy to forget that there's a vast number of, you know, funny, educated, intelligent people in America who, you know, are interested in all sorts of different points of view. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, right-wing stuff taking center stage, I think, wherever you go in the world these days. And I guess I'm writing for the rest of them.
Yeah. Fear. I think it's fear. I don't know what it is, but I think part of it's fear. You know, the people feel a little insecure these days, and religion's a good fallback, maybe.
Yes, and I think economic insecurity doesn't make people more, you know, morally expansive either. You know, I think everybody is worried and they don't particularly like challenges. But, you know, my feeling is these religions have been around for a really, really long time. And, you know, if a writer sitting in North London, you know, writing a comedy for teenagers is going to upset the apple cart, then I think everyone would be a little surprised.
You are listening to 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. My guest this morning is Meg Rossoff. The book is There Is No Dog. I want to talk a little bit about writing young adult fiction for our young adult writers out there, kind of the rules, how far you can go with sex, how far you can go with religion, how, if there are lines that you have to be aware of when you're writing for the young adult audience, or if all of those rules have sort of gone kind of out the window with the more sophisticated teenagers today.
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. And actually, that was the first question I asked my agent when I sat down to write my first book. And she memorably, I'd sort of written a practice novel that was a horse book. And she said, look, I'm not sure I can sell a horse book with quite so much sex in it. And it wasn't that it was so sexy. It was that it was sort of dark. And so I said to her, well, okay, I'll write another one, but what are the rules? And she said, really, there are no actual rules. Just write the very, very best book you can write, and I'll find an audience for it. And I was thinking back on that. I think, well, yeah, no rules except for not too much sex in horse books. But, the thing is, I don't feel I'm actually writing for teenagers. I'm writing about adolescents. And I think because of that, I have quite a big audience of teenagers and an audience of adults as well. But, you know, most 14, 15-year-olds who are good readers are reading everything. So, you know, I almost wonder if it's more of a worldview that makes you a teen writer. You know, for instance, you tend not to get books that leave you absolutely drowning in despair. Mm-hmm. for the teen market. But that doesn't mean that you can't look at almost any question, you know, life, death, sex, drugs, you know, whatever, in an interesting and critical way.
Which is funny because all teenagers seem like they're drowning in despair. So, you know.
Well, I think that's why. You know, yeah. I always think that the one taboo, and people ask me about it all the time, is, you know, I wouldn't ever want to read a book that sort of made somebody feel so, you know, so depressed that they, you know, that it tipped them over in some way. Even though I am a terrible pessimist and an atheist and a nihilist and, you know, all those kinds of things, but I'm a grown-up one and I'm quite a funny one as well. You know, I somehow managed to enjoy life despite all that. But I think this can be a lack of perspective, you know, among depressive 14, 15, 16-year-olds. And, you know, that's my one thing. I just wouldn't want to encourage anyone to do anything terrible.
Right. Yeah, I've always talked about teenagers as having not gone through this cycle of pain. So, you know, they can't see the other side of things
that's
to realize
right.
things are
going down, but they haven't come up yet.
Yeah, right. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think your humor in this goes so far to, as a, you know, I think the most pessimistic, stoic people have the best sense of humor, at least the driest sense of humor, which tends to save them. And certainly this book is no exception to that. That's.
Yes, I've never really understood that connection, but it's definitely true. I mean, I remember thinking that reading an American short story writer whose stories were just made me really want to go and hang myself. And when I finally met her, I said, God, you must be really incredibly depressive. And she goes, no, I'm really cheerful. I'm really happy. I never really get down very much. And I thought, well, maybe you just have to be really cheerful in order to write stuff that depressing.
That could be true. That could be true. Now, so in the realm of rules for young adults, there's also the corollary question, I guess, which is the rules in your own universe for the novel and where you kind of hold the religious truths of, you know, the world was created, all the stories of the world was created in 7 days so that it looks familiar to an audience, and then you deviate from it. So tell me about your kind of the construction of the internal rules of the novel, where you make nod to the religious stories, where you use those to jump off, and kind of the internal set of logical rules that had to be in place.
I would say think of it as a smoothie. You know, there's, you know, I'm 55 years old. I've been collecting stuff in my brain since I was, you know, since I first started thinking about religion when I was about 6 or 7. When I was terribly young, I used to lie in bed contemplating eternal nothingness. And this always makes me think that I was born an atheist, even though, you know, by rights, I could easily have believed in a Jewish God, but I somehow just never did. So these questions, you know, and some of them are really basic. Like I remember being about 10 years old and waiting at a bus stop and thinking, you know, they're telling me at school that man is the greatest creation, you know, in the universe, and what's this design flaw? Why do I have to wait for a bus? You know, I should be able to just kind of blink my eyes and be home. You know, it's that kind of theological questioning, I think, that I was doing from a very young age and really all my life. And yeah, so even though I'm an atheist, I always think that people going around crusading about atheism is much too simple an answer as well, because, you know, okay, so there is no God, but so why do 5 billion out of 7 billion in the world believe in God? And, you know, that's all the stuff that's been kind of rolling around in my brain as to making rules for the world. You know, I hear about people who write fantasy novels who say that they, you know, they have to have a distinct set of rules that governs their worlds. I'm not really that kind of writer. I sort of sit down with an idea in my head and start writing and see where it takes me.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, it's I wonder how much of the common writer experience are the depressed little kids who sit alone in their room. And I'm not saying you were a depressed little kid. I don't know.
But I probably was. Yeah.
But the kids,
it's a great solace for all the little depressed kids out there listening. You know, you may turn out to be a really good writer.
It does seem to be a recurring theme.
It's people who think too much, isn't it? And worry too much about the world. I mean, I'm amazed when I hear that people didn't lie in bed contemplating eternal nothingness. And of course, a lot of people did. You know, Woody Allen famously said that he did. And I think William Golding as well was somebody who was terrified by eternal nothingness. So, you know, maybe...
I don't know how you don't. I mean, you know, I get plagued by these now and then. It was a different topic for a different day. But yeah, I don't know how you don't contemplate it, because it's...
It would be easier, really, if you didn't. I mean, the thing is, as you get older, you have to worry about your mortgage and, you know, getting your kid to school and back and you know, whether the sheets need changing and all that. And so there's a little bit less time to contemplate big theological questions.
Right.
But, you know, they stick around.
Thank God for the noise of life to save us from ourselves,
exactly,
right?
Yeah. Exactly.
And now tell me, so you've had... several young adult books come out over the time. Tell me, over the course of writing, if that task gets easier, if there are things, lessons garnered over time that when you sit down to the fifth one or the fourth one, what's easier for you than the first one, or are things getting more difficult?
Oh, goodness. Yes, I've got a very sad answer to that one, which is no, it doesn't get easier, I don't think. And I mean, I was very lucky with my first novel. It came to me in a minute, and it took me about 3 months to write and became a kind of nearly a worldwide bestseller. Mm. And so I thought, wow, you know, I should have started writing much earlier because it's so easy. And then the second one was rejected by both my American and my UK editor in the first draft. And they didn't even say, you know, well, you've written a great, really great book before. You know, keep at it. You'll get it right eventually. They both basically just said, drop it. And I didn't. I kept working on it, and it won the Carnegie Medal in the end, which was a nice kind of I told you so moment. But, you know, basically I think as a writer you're excavating your brain with every book. And, you know, unless you're writing the same thing over and over again, which a lot of people do, and which is fine. But if you're like me and you're sort of looking for, you know, big questions that have been plaguing you your whole life to sort of try to work out in a novel, you know, I have this terror that my brain is getting emptier and emptier, and, you know, one or two more books and that'll be it. And I always have absolute terror, you know, that this one won't work. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was teaching a creative writing weekend in England with a group of 15 adults, and they all came in, they were all saying, oh God, you know, yeah, we've tried writing a book, but we get halfway through and then we get really stuck. And I just looked at them and I said, look, everybody gets stuck halfway through. That's what happens. You know, you keep going. So there's a lot of fear, I think. I always say I'm motivated by fear. You know, fear that this will be the last book, fear that I won't finish it, fear that it won't be any good, that nobody will tell me, you know, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, 25 years I worked, you know, 9 to 5 or 8 to 8, and it's a lot nicer than that.
It's funny, as you're talking about it, it sort of strikes me how similar the writing process is to the living process and all the uncertainty, and you get kind of halfway through and feel lost, right?
Which, yeah, no, it's exactly like that. And in fact, I have a little bit of a theory that if you lose the fear, that you actually lose the edge as well. You lose what makes you good. And I think there's some truth about that as well. I think if you get too complacent and you think, God, my husband will love me every minute, you know, for the rest of my life, and my kids will, you know, you can't lose the appreciation of how lucky you've been up until that exact moment.
Right, right. And how some lightning bolt can drop out and change the
yes,
entire
exactly.
plot of your life.
It can all change in a second, and you'll look back on this moment when you kind of wish you were 10 pounds thinner or something and think, God, that was the happiest time of my life.
Right, right. Let's talk a little bit about voice, accessing the voice, particularly, you know, a 19-year-old boy, 19-year-old God.
Yeah.
And you have talked about how voice is more important to you than plot, the character is more important to you than plot, and that this is all sort of trying on different costumes and taking stage as a different actor on the set. Tell me a little bit about accessing the voice of some of these characters. Who came to you the most easily, who came to you the most difficult, and getting into them?
Well, I mean, voice in general, I think of as, you know, the writer's sort of deepest impulse, and then there are voices on top of that, the voices of your characters. But if you have a really good, deep, honest, you know, hard-won voice, then you can access all those different characters. Now, you know, I can easily write in the voice of say a 19-year-old boy or a 16-year-old girl or whatever. But I can't write in the voice of every 16-year-old girl or every 19-year-old boy. You know, I've pointed out to somebody, you know, saying that I do male characters and female characters with equal ease. But, you know, I couldn't write an Arnold Schwarzenegger type of male. I can only write a slightly wimpy, slightly introspective, rather needy male, because that connects with something in me.
I like it. Sadly, we're drawing down on our time. I'm wondering if you have wisdom, advice, or words of insight for young adult writers or writers in general.
Yes, I mean, I think don't be in a hurry is my biggest bit of wisdom. I published my first book when I was 47, and, you know, sometimes The more you live and the more things you do, the better your voice gets. And that allows you also to put every lousy relationship and every terrible fight you have with your parents, you know, into a box that you can use later someday when you've sort of digested it.
You have this great quote about it's like compost, all that lovely rich stuff on the forest floor from years and years of leaves falling down that that you draw from.
That is how I kind of see it. Mm-hmm. You know, my adolescence went from about the age of 14 to about 40 and possibly 55. And, you know, all that stuff, it kind of collects and collects and collects. And the older you get, the more it starts to make sense and the more you start to make sense of life. And I always think the trajectory you want, you don't want to be famous at 17, despite what all the reality TV shows tell you. You want your life to be a lovely uphill, gentle slope so that the day before you die is the happiest day of your life.
Now,
anyway, that's
encouraging.
That's what I aspire to.
That is encouraging. I like that.
There's me says, always hope.
That's the best thing I've heard all decade.
Good. I'll make you a sampler.
Thank you. Thank you. Meg Rossoff, this was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Meg Rossoff. The book is There Is No Dog, and it is out now, just a week old, and available to you. Buy it at your local independent bookstores. We are pushing our favorite local independent bookstores. Don't let them go under. That's all the time we have for today. Barbara will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.